Good morning, everybody. My name's Harold. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Hey, I apologize for being late. We have a major storm here in the Midwest. I'm out of St. Louis, Missouri, and the internet's not working this morning, so I'm coming to you on my cell phone. I got my timer on. I don't know if I'll be able to see your timer, but I got my timer on, and if I run over just or if I get short, just somebody wave me on. But it's a privilege to be here with you this morning. My sobriety date's April 7th, 1987. My home group here in St. Louis, Missouri is called AA on the Rocks, and we meet on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m., strong pre-legacy group here. I come from a great line of sponsorship. My sponsor most of my sobriety was Tom I. Some of you may know Tom. He's still alive today. He's sober 65 years, just had 65 years on Groundhog Day, but unfortunately he has Alzheimer's, is in a long-term care facility, so he hasn't been in the capacity to sponsor for a good while. So I have another sponsor, Steve L. out of Nashville. And that's the sponsorship line I come out of today. But all those, I tell you all those things because that's all those things made a big difference in how my life turned out and the life I enjoy today. Welcome to the new people and those who are trying to come back and just find a place here, find true kinship here, a sense of belonging, and a place to call home. I don't have a long to talk, so I'm just going to talk about the highlights of my life, especially the what I would call the delusions that I had to overcome in my life to get to the life that I have today. And the first delusion is I'm not alcoholic, right? I mean, that delusion wipes out so many of us in the world today. It's just a powerful, cunning, baffling, powerful illness that we suffer from. And, you know, I found alcohol early on. I was raised by a single mother. My dad was an alcoholic who my mother ran off when I was young. And so I was just raised by her. And she didn't have much means, so we lived in a lot of beat up places, and she was working and gone a lot. And so by the time I was 10, I was growing up on the streets, and I would come and go as I pleased. I was a rock and roll drummer, and so that served me well, got me into some circles where I normally maybe not get into, but I found alcohol at an early age. My mom drank her whole life up till she died in 2015. Did I ever drink some of her alcohol? I'm sure I did. I know I stole from her and smoked her cigarettes, but none of that's real clear to me, but I don't count any of that as a first drink for me. My first real drink came right around the age between 11 and 12 years old when I was invited to one of my band members' houses for a party. He was 17, and I was just between 11 and 12. And that's when I was introduced to King alcohol for the first time, and it changed my life. It was an apocalyptic moment. Apocalyptic meaning something that's been revealed to you that's never been revealed to you before. And this delusion of inequality that I suffered from my whole life, this delusion of trying to fit in somewhere and never really finding that and always having that turmoil going on between my ears emotionally, mentally, spiritually, even physically, was the challenge I had long before I ever found the drink. But when I found the drink, it transformed my life. It just changed my life forever. And the effect alcohol had on my life, you know, that night I made a pledge, you know, internally that this, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. And it wasn't just the effect alcohol had on my life, but it was the whole atmosphere. I loved every part of that moment, that scene, that experience. And so it changed my life forever. I got as sick as I've ever been off alcohol that night, probably, or close to it. I'm sure I said my first foxhole prayer or plea bargain prayer that night. And I'm sure that I lied to my mother about what was going on with me or what my condition was. I didn't drink the next day, I'm sure, or the next week, maybe even the next month. But it wasn't long before I was that centerpiece, that became the centerpiece of my life, that lifestyle. And we didn't have much means, so unfortunately I started to do crimes and break in places and steal things, and that cost me a lot. And ultimately took me away from my mother and put me into juvenile facilities and juvenile penitentiary. Eventually I quit school when I was 13. I left home when I was 15. And I wouldn't have my first real run-in of any kind of concession with King alcohol until I was 19 years old. By this time, I'm living in the South, down in Georgia, and that's where I had my first real moment. Now, I had a lot of consequences with drinking early on, and up to this point, so there was a lot of moments, turning points in my life that maybe I would have saw the light or had some real true honesty in my life about my condition, but none of that came through until age 19, and even when it did at that time, it quickly was smashed. Now, I was introduced to AA in 1979 in the Department of Corrections in Adair County Detention Center, and I was far from being with you people or wanting to belong to you people or identifying with you people or conceding to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. As I bonded out on that charge, I just got out of Boonville Correctional Center, and it was a plea bargain deal: either go back to Boonville for 2.5 more years, or go to the treatment center for 30 days. Well, I quit school when I was 13, but I sure knew that 30 days was a heck of a lot shorter than 2.5 years. So I went into the treatment center for the first time, right in 1980. Again, I went there to do 30 days, like I was doing 30 days in a county jail, and I got out, and I was drinking within a half hour after leaving. And so that brought me to Georgia in the mid 80s, somewhere in the mid 80s. I was 19 years old, and I woke up from a all night bender at the honky tonks. I was a bar drinker, loved the bars, loved the honky tonks. And, I woke up with a big tomato head. That's what we called the hangover in the South. And I woke up with a big tomato head. And as I woke up from a blackout, which was normal for me, as I looked at my clothes, I realized that I was fully dressed, had on blue jeans and boots and a flannel shirt. It was wintertime, and I had on a beige cutoff jacket. But I realized I had dry blood all over. I had dry blood on my hands and everywhere. And I couldn't figure out what had happened to me. And as I went into the bathroom and started to try to figure out where I was bleeding from, and I got undressed and realized somebody sliced me all around my arm and stabbed me in my chest, in my rib cage. And so I went out on the front porch of that trailer and got as emotional that I can ever remember about my life and about what was going on and where I was at in life and the trouble that I had and the pain that I was suffering. And you know, I had snot running out my nose. I mean, I was that emotional about it. And I mumbled something to the effect, man, I got to do something different than what I'm doing. But the problem with this illness, this malady, this thing we call king alcoholism, is it's so embedded in delusion. You know, we toss the word denial around in recovery, but it's only mentioned twice, once in Bill's story and once in the spiritual appendix. But when it talks about our illness, it talks about it on the basis of delusion and illusion, meaning we can't see ourselves for what we really are, and we can't differentiate the true from the false. And it's that delusion that unfortunately wipes out so many of us. And so if we're on this call today, which I know there's many, and we have a strong desire not to drink, then I hope we all hang on to that with everything we have, because if it ever slips through our fingers, there's no guarantee we'd ever draw a sober breath again. And so as I sat on this porch, this delusion, how it plays out is what I'm about to explain to you. As I sat there and making some kind of concession that I want to live a different life, it was just like King Alcohol was sitting next to me with his arm around me and almost whispering in my ear, going and saying something to the effect, you know what, kid, you're right. You do need to do something different. But before you do anything drastic, go in here and grab your old army jacket. And let's walk up here to the Magic Market and get a quart of beer and a pack of smokes. And as dark and as evil and as broken as that idea sounded, it was pretty refreshing, at least for the moment. I went and got the army jacket. I didn't even wash the blood off my hands. I started walking up to the Magic Market, and that sense of ease and comfort came over me before I ever got there. I was already feeling better. I got the liquor. I got the cigarettes. I came out and twisted that cap off that thing, made that noise we all love. When that little spirit pops out of the bottle, and I took a mighty pull off it, and I made that face. We always make that first big pull we take, and that was the last time I thought about not drinking for a couple more years. I hitchhiked to Marietta, Georgia, got sewed up, and the game was on. And that's alcoholism. And if you're on this call today and you suffer from that type of delusion, that type of powerlessness over the mind and this obsession of the mind and this allergy of the body, then you're in the right place. And I found victory here. I found relief here. I found a lot of things here. But one thing is, I got that illness off my back, you know, at least in the degree that it was, it had me definitely enslaved for sure. I came back to St. Louis in 1985, and it would be 1987 when I finally crashed and burned. A multitude of things happened, but ultimately I had a fourth DWI conviction. A few weeks later, I was involved in a fatality drunk driving accident. I wasn't driving. I was a passenger of one of the vehicles, but everybody else in the other vehicle lost their lives. And then just, you know, and I came home from that just a destroyed human being. I mean, it's like somebody just cut my soul out, because I could see the darkness. I could see the toxicity. I could see the evil of all that. And ultimately only to pick up again and be behind the wheel of a car just a week or so later and arrested for a 50 WI. And so I had felony DWIs, parole violation, 21 going on 22, and on my way back to the penitentiary. And it would be in St. Louis County Jail where I would finally just concede that, you know, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. It was the ultimate surrender. And I prayed the most honest prayer I've ever said in my life, which is simply three words: God help me. And I love in Gnostics, it says that God doesn't make too hard of turns for those who honestly seek God. And this is guaranteed the first time I was honestly seeking God in a mighty way. And from that day, as Bill would say in his story, that God's impact on my life was sudden and profound, because I never drank from that day till now. And that's almost 35 years later. I made my way to treatment, back to that same treatment center, a couple hours from St. Louis. I didn't go there to go to AA. I didn't go there to get a sponsor. I just went there because it was a safe place. And I went there because I knew I needed something for the courts. When I got to the courts, I needed something. And so I went, but I was fortunate to be 12-step by a guy who had only had a couple months of sobriety. He just got out of that treatment center, and he 12-stepped me, and it changed my life. He didn't become my sponsor or get me into the steps. He just became my friend. He just became an adequate example that there's a better way to live. And thank God he was persistent. He stayed with me as I got back to St. Louis. I didn't go to AA right away. I was consumed with this trial. The trial consumed me. And I came back, and it took me a long time. Let me just put it that way, a few months before I finally got the courage to go to AA. And he would say things, Harold, you got to go because your life depends on it. And I knew that was a true statement. I didn't want it to be a true statement, but I knew it was true. And so finally I went to AA, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the same way I did everything else in my life. I'm going to do what I want, how I want, when I want, the way I want. If you don't like it, too bad, because that's how I'm going to do it. That just driven by self-propulsion, just that right to myself that I claimed long before I ever drank. And I came in with that attitude, and I don't recommend that to anybody. My first 3 years of sobriety are as much about what not to do as they are to do. I didn't want a sponsor. I had a probation and parole officer almost my entire life. I didn't believe the steps would change my life. As Clancy used to say all the time, that, the hardest thing any of us ever do is take actions we don't believe in. And that's such a true statement. It was for me. I just didn't believe that 12 steps would change my life. I had too much world in me. I needed money and power and glory and prestige. This is what I needed in my life to be happy, joyous, and free, and to have a whole life. I didn't understand the spiritual mathematics here that were at play. And it would be almost 3 years before I finally crashed and burned, at least emotionally and spiritually I crashed. And I asked the guy to sponsor me. And his name was Roy at the time. And he invited me to his house. He said, Harold, you've been here almost 3 years now. Tell me about your life. And I said, I'll tell you about my life. Roy, I said, I'm 25 years old. I live in the basement of a house. I don't have any education. I don't even have a GED. I got a criminal record. I don't have a driver's license. I got a piece of crap car that's held together by bumper stickers that I can't legally drive, but I do anyway. My life sucks just every which way you want to take it. Take the word sucks, highlight it, italicize it, make a neon sign out of it, and just flash it. Sucks, sucks, sucks. That's where my life was at. And I hadn't drank, almost 3 years. And he let me finish. And then what he said to me changed my life. He said, Harold, I hear everything you're saying. And there's no doubt that you've had, a challenging life. You've been dealt a tough hand. But I hope you're going to hear what I'm going to say. And what he said was simply this, that everything you have in your life, Harold, you have because of the person that you become. And the day you're man enough to own that truth is the day you're on your way to some real change. But until you can own that truth, this little path you're on, you're eventually going to drink again because you're not happy about your sobriety. Or you're going to end up doing what my dad did. My dad was an alcoholic. He could never get sober. He ended up taking his life. So it's going to boil down to two things, Harold. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And, man, I didn't want to go. I had enough friendships and relationships here, and I had a sober band. I played on sober softball teams. I wasn't ready to leave, but I still was. I still had a little bit of that self in me. But I had to come to the end of myself, and that's what every one of us have to do. We have to come to the end of ourselves, and I finally did, and I started to take the work, adopt this design for living, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions and the concepts, all 36 principles into my life. And it totally transformed my life. It didn't happen in one big cataclysmic explosion, but it happened pretty quick. But, in that steps right away, I ran up against the next delusion. Delusion number one is I'm not alcoholic. Delusion number two is I am alcoholic, but it's not my fault. That lovely little word called victimization, or as the fourth step would say, to conclude that others was wrong is about as far as most of us ever get. And that was me. I mean, I'm a textbook AA guy. And I had a blame list and excuse list a mile long while my life was in the tank. But the problem with that victimization, and I know there's probably people here that are stuck in that today, is that, man, you can literally drink yourself to death and it's not your fault. You can sit in a 9x7 or 10x6 jail cell for the rest of your life and it's not your fault. You can blow your lungs out. You can blow your brains out. You can blow your veins out. You can just you can blow your whole life up, and it's not your fault. And that's where I was at. But through the four-step, fifth-step, and great sponsorship, I was finally able to toss that victim card. But it bounced right up against this next delusion. And the delusion was I could come in and say, well, my name's Harold, I'm an alcoholic, and I'll take full responsibility for my life. But let's just be real with each other. I've burnt too many bridges. I've broke too many hearts. There's little hope that my life will ever amount to anything. So why even try? And that was a delusion that I was stuck in. And I just believed that time had passed me by. The mountain was too big. But I didn't understand the spiritual mathematics that we have here on page 64 when it says that when we put the spiritual ahead of the material, we straighten out physically, we straighten out mentally, you can add emotionally and spiritually to it, but we finally straighten out. And that's what happened to me. I was able to get past that. My sponsor, Tom, used to say, when God's got work for you to do, the walls come down. And the walls came down in my life, and 2 + 2 didn't equal 4 anymore, and the impossible became possible. My life started to take off, and opportunities came. I had a lot of bumps in the road. I'm like a stock chart. I just continued to go up, but I had my slipbacks with just self. But through that, you know, I was able to overcome a lot of things and able to go back to school eventually and get a GED in my 30s. It took me that long, and finally walked across the stage and get a bachelor's degree, and then ultimately came a master's in business, where I wrote a thesis to start a business from scratch and sell it. And I've done that not once, but twice. And then ultimately walk across the stage and get another master's degree. I have a wife. I have 5 children. I just had my first grandchild, you know, and so it's an awesome way to live. And when that first child was born, I didn't know I could fall in love with a little bald-headed woman with no teeth until they handed me one, you know, and now they just handed me another one, my grandchild. So that delusion was powerful. The delusion that I was spiritually disqualified was another one. And that delusion, because I come to meetings, I hear you talk about this higher power, this God, this spirit, this world of the spirit, this heavenly realm. And God sounded like this to me when I got here. But it would take the 4th and 5th step, really 4 through 9, to really clear the tube. You know, this is my channel. This is a channel that was completely blocked. It was completely blocked by resentments and secrets and just a lot of junk in my life. And the steps helped me unclog that channel. And it's through that process of unclogging that channel that I had the spiritual experience that you promised me I would have, but I delayed it for 3 years because of self. And the last delusion is the delusion of purpose. You know, I just didn't, you know, I do all this stuff. We go to these meetings, and for what? What is the real purpose? And we talk about all kinds of purpose in recovery. We talk about our singleness of purpose and our primary purpose and our group purpose and our real purpose. But living into that. And I'll close with this. On page 152, it says this. It's the alcoholic asking the book of questions, how I would frame it. It says, do you have a sufficient substitute for King Alcohol? And the book responds with yes, and it's vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that word fellowship being in a verb form, not a noun, meaning I have to participate in my own sobriety. But it tells me if I do that, if I come all the way in, sit all the way down, and stay with you people, that the most satisfactory years of my existence lie ahead of me. That I'm going to make lifelong friends here. But most importantly, and I think this is where we find the purpose, it says, it goes on, and I'm paraphrasing for the sake of time, but it goes on to say that you're going to have the privilege to walk shoulder to shoulder with other people and help them rediscover life and friends. And it goes on to conclude that with, and then you're going to finally know what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. And so you have to move. It's 18 inches from your head to your heart. When that shift happens, it's a game changer. It changed my life. And I owe all that to Alcoholics Anonymous and everything you people taught me, continue to teach me, what you share with me and how you walk with me, hold me accountable, and give me an example to follow. So thank you, Pacific Group, for allowing me to chime in here with you this morning. Again, I apologize for the technology. It's pouring right now where I'm at, but I'm grateful I was able to jump on in another way and be with you this morning. Thank you for that opportunity. Thank you for my life, Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's all I got.